From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In just 4 days, it's opening ceremony time at the Olympics in Athens. Security concerns, major construction delays, and a record-breaking $7.2 billion price tag that would make even Atlas stagger had some wondering if the Olympic flame would burn out even before the torch came back to Greece. Against the ropes, Athens looked like it was in trouble. The stadium and pool had no roofs, ticket sales were weak, a steroid scandal threatened track and field. But the Greeks appear to have pulled it out in the nick of time. The athletes are gathering. The gunboats are on patrol. Tonight on Point, raising the curtain on the Athens Olympics. We begin in Athens. John Sarropoulos is editor of the Athens News. I asked him, is Athens ready?
Well, Greek officials have always said we will be ready because we have to be. But that actually seems to become more than a rhetorical device now and become a reality. The venues are all finished. The transport networks that needed to be built, a suburban railroad, a new tram line, and so on, they are finished. The Athenians seem to be psychologically ready for it. They seem to be complying with some very restrictive traffic rules. It seems as though things are ready to begin more or less tomorrow.
So after all the hand-wringing and woe and rushing and huge number of construction projects, you're saying it's there, it's ready, bring them on.
Well, in reality, there have only been two or three cliffhangers in the last 6 months. One of those was the stadium roof, which was an enormous steel and glass construction. And at some point, they got that on track around about mid-May. Another one was the very vaunted Olympic security system, which is being designed by an American defense contractor, Science Applications International Corporation. And they were even more of a cliffhanger because this system, which is really the nerve center of all the law enforcement, that thing wasn't really working until a week ago.
And now it is, and the athletes are beginning to arrive. John Sarropoulos, just remind us for a moment of the incredible makeover that Athens has done to prepare for these games, of all the sort of range of physical infrastructure projects that have been carried out.
First of all the major central squares were rebuilt, in effect. They were laid down again with new stone, a lot of new trees planted, and so on. A lot of buildings were encouraged to repaint their facades, just residential apartment buildings. And they were given a third of the cost from the state. And a lot of people did that.
Mm-hmm.
All the major hotels underwent extensive renovations, $60, $70 million worth in the case of the Hilton, for example. And some of the streets have been repaved. But the most noticeable thing, I think, is the new tram network, which just didn't exist until a few months ago. And perhaps beyond that, the extensions to the underground metro system and a suburban railroad system that links the center of the town to the airport. The links have been affected. The stations have been built. Two enormous new ring roads around the town. It's all ready to go. It surprised even the Greeks themselves, I think.
John, paint a picture for us of how the games relate to the city. You have a few games that are within eyeshot of the Acropolis and the Parthenon, but then others spread well outside Athens. What's the relationship between the city and the venues for the games?
Well, they are not concentrated in a sort of square mile or anything like that, but there are three major complexes. One of them is the Olympic Stadium complex, which is up in the northern suburbs. And that's where all the water sports, the swimming and diving, happen and the tennis.
Right.
And the second major center is down by the sea in the Bay of Phaleron. And that is where beach volleyball and badminton and certain other ball sports happen. And then the third major center is in the old, now abandoned airport, which houses basketball, baseball, softball, and kayaking.
What about on the security front? There's been so much attention paid to that, John. Can Athens be said to be ready? Is it possible to protect such an enormous event with so many visitors?
Well, I think the most responsible and authoritative people will tell you that it's not possible to make a guarantee of 100% safety for any event. But the fact is that if you look around the streets of Athens now, there are policemen on every major intersection. There are police vehicles tearing up and down the avenues. There's obviously enormous vigilance, obviously an enormous outlay of extra personnel going on. And you can see from what's visible, the security has been stepped up enormously. The invisible parts of the security network, are the really important ones, as anyone will tell you. And as far as we know, they're all working.
And finally, John, speak to us for just a moment about the Greeks' attitude toward all this. Of course, the ancient games were theirs. They were the first venue when the games came back in 1896. Now they spent $7.2 billion. What's the attitude in the streets about this tremendous influx of world athletes and attention?
Well, the average Greek is very proud to have the games here. There's no question. On the other hand, people are very worried about the cost. And I think that the end result will be that Greece will have graduated into a group of nations that have proven themselves capable of handling enormously complex and responsible international events. But at the same time, Greece is going to take years to work off a burden of debt that has clocked up not just because of the Olympics, but because of the highly regulated economy.
John Siropoulos, we know you're right there in downtown Athens. We appreciate your being with us. Thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
John Siropoulos is editor of the Athens News. He spoke with me from downtown Athens. Earlier today, I also caught up with John Powers, longtime Olympics writer for the Boston Globe, now in Athens, covering his 14th Olympic Games. He's checked out the sports venues, and I asked him how Athens looks from the athlete's perspective.
We were talking to some of the U.S. athletes today, and they're very pleased, especially those of them who were here earlier for events in the last year or two. And they were saying that there was some question then as to whether things would be done, but they got here, and the buses seem to be working, and the athletes' village is actually one of the best ever. And all of the venues appear to be ready. So in the limited world that they live in, which basically is their competition here, they seem quite happy.
And after all the talk about things not being ready and fear of terrorism, do you sense a different mood among athletes as they're arriving, or does the Olympic excitement take over and shove all that to the margins, or not, John?
Well, I think they feel here as though everything has been done that can possibly be done in terms of keeping them safe. Certainly in the village, there is a double wall. There are all sorts of troops outside guarding them. They aren't worried about that. And also, these are athletes that have lived in the post-9/11 world for 3 years now. They've been traveling all over the world. They've been in areas that have been quite dangerous. They don't seem worried here. There does seem to be a feeling that once you are at Olympus, the rest of the world kind of falls away.
And how about the Olympics organizer? It was just a few years ago that the top folks in the International Olympic Committee were very critical of Greece. The Greeks are saying they're ready. Is the IOC buying it?
I think they have been pleasantly surprised. Jacques Rogge, who is the president of the IOC, came and said that he is quite delighted. And now, of course, he is more concerned about Italy getting ready for the next Winter Games in 2006. He thinks that Turin really ought to get rolling. So most of the pressure is off. There were two things, I think, that really changed attitudes around here. One was when the roof of the stadium finally got locked in place. That was the one symbol of unfinishedness around here. Once that got in place, things seemed to move. The other thing that really improved the mood was the Greek soccer team coming out of nowhere to win the European Championship.
Yeah.
And they figured if they can do that, if they can beat Portugal in Portugal, if they can beat teams that they shouldn't be on the same field with, then the rest of us can do all this together. So it was to them a very symbolic example of what happens when Greeks pull together. So I think that plus a lot of overtime, a lot of round-the-clock craziness, got the place done.
John, take us into a bit of what it's all about, the sports themselves, the main contests, the main focus or foci are going to be in this Olympics.
Well, I think one of the issues that just simply won't go away is the doping issue. I know it's been a big issue for the U.S. track team. They've had numerous athletes banned, numerous athletes who didn't make the team who had been accused of using drugs. There's a shadow over Marion Jones, who was the queen of Sydney in track, had not tested positive, hasn't been accused of anything, but is being investigated. So that is a feeling here that there is some concern that there'll be some doping positives here, or even after the games when they go back and test some samples. The interesting thing here is the speculation the U.S. basketball team might lose, which has not happened since they used NBA players here. So the one thing here is that there is a sense of a very different world here. I mean, you've got Iraq that will be competing here, and for the first time, the athletes won't be worried about being tortured. The Afghans are back after having been banned. They will have at least one woman on their team. So there is a sense that this is a very different world and a very different place, even at Olympus, since Sydney in 2000.
And what about the American team that's showing up this week? I've seen projections that they should take home the highest medal count, but how does it look as it compared to past Summer Olympics? Are they in good shape?
Yes, I think the feeling was they have been topping the table basically ever since the breakup of the Soviet Union. They have been getting around 100 medals, and that's what they themselves, the USOC, is hoping for here if everything goes right. This is funny. It's one of the oldest U.S. Olympic teams ever. The average age is about 27, and there are numerous athletes over 30, over 40, even over 50 here. A number of athletes in the third, fourth, fifth, even sixth Olympics. So we're calling it the red, white, and gray.
John, you've been to a lot of Olympics over the years. How about the overall mood or theme of the Olympics this year?
Well, what is interesting about this one, of course, is now these are when the games come back to the place that they were born. And there are reminders everywhere around here about antiquity. For example, the stadium that was used in 1896 when the games were revived is still in place downtown. The marathon will end there. The archery will be held there. So I am much more struck here by a sense of 2,000 years of Olympic history. And I think that's what the Greeks are selling here when you take the bus in from the airport. The big signs say, "Welcome home." So all of us feel as though we are all coming back to a place that this great circle has been rounded after a couple of thousand years.
Well, I'm sure that television viewers around the world will become very familiar with that iconic towering Parthenon over Athens as the days move ahead. John Powers, good luck with your coverage there. Thanks so much for joining us. Love to talk to you again. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
John Powers is Olympics writer for the Boston Globe. He spoke with me from Athens. Tonight we're raising the curtain on the Summer Olympics. Are you pumped up for the games in Athens? Is the image of the Parthenon rising over the Olympics going to glue you to your seat? Does the narrative of the terror threat trump the athletes on the field? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Bill Saporito, editor-at-large at Time magazine. He's directing Time's Olympic coverage in Athens and was at the helm for the games in Sydney and Salt Lake City. Bill Saporito, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So you've just heard a couple of our correspondents tell us that after all their trials, the Athenians are pulling it out. Is that what your correspondents are telling you, Bill? Does it look like it's going to be ready to roll with the opening ceremony on Friday?
Well, it is ready to roll, whether you're ready or not. Now, in every Olympics, no city is really ready, ever. It's just a matter of how far you get, how close you get to the finish. And as of 2 weeks ago, Athens was farthest from the finish of anyone had ever been. And they've sprinted, basically, and done a great job. And the games are going to go on.
So good enough. The roof is over the main stadium. The swimming pool still without a roof?
Well, there's water in the pool, though, isn't there? So what do you need a roof if you've got water in the pool?
So let them dive. A huge expense, $7.2 billion. The Greeks talking about paying that for generations. Of course, this is the smallest country to host a Summer Olympics since Finland in 1952, if I recall correctly. What do you think the Olympic Committee's taken away from all this, Bill? Did they misjudge in sending this huge event back to little Greece?
They certainly did, and I think you will not see a country that's this small and this poor, really. Greece, I think the average income is about $11,000 a year. It is too much for a country like this to handle, even though they seem to have pulled it off. They're going to be staggering under this debt load for a while. Even big cities have had a problem with it. You remember that Montreal was paying off $1 billion in debt, I believe, for 20, 30 years. It really set that city back a long time. So for the future, I think the International Olympic Committee is going to look at cities that already have a significant infrastructure. For instance, Paris, New York, that kind of deal. Remember, the Greeks basically did 100 years of urban renewal in four.
Right.
So it was some job, yeah.
Pretty amazing. We are going to spend the hour tonight looking at Athens on the eve of the Olympics. Friday night will be the opening ceremonies, and we'll look forward to those as well. You can join our conversation tonight. The curtain going up this week on the Athens Olympics. Has the helter-skelter race to be ready in Greece turned you on or turned you away? Is it time to move the games to a secluded island somewhere, not so hard to defend? And what's the event you're waiting for in the 2004 Summer Olympics in Athens, Greece? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Olympics coming home to Greece this summer, just in a few days now, 108 years after their modern revival. You can join our conversation tonight. Is the image of the Parthenon rising over the Games going to glue you to your seat? Have the steroid scandals, the drug scandals, undercut your enthusiasm for the Games? Does the narrative of the terror threat trump the athletics on the field this year or not? What are you looking for in Athens? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from New York by Bill Saporito, editor-at-large for Time Magazine, in charge of Olympic coverage in Athens. And also from New York right now by Sean Assale, author and senior writer at the ESPN, the magazine. He's been covering the track and field steroid scandal. Sean Assale, thank you for joining us tonight.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Tom.
So here we are, first day, and let's just get this out of the way right away. They started testing, and already we've got two Greek baseball players, or perhaps more accurately, two Greek-American baseball players, a Swiss cyclist, a Spanish canoe team member, an Irish distance runner, all lost their places because of doping charges. Is there more to come? And what about American athletes? Are we going to have dope problems?
Oh, I mean, sure. You're going to have a story within a story. You're going to keep your scorecard out, and you're going to begin to cross your favorite athletes off. I mean, look, this thing has become a big business for the Olympics. They are out to show that they can be diligent, that the past scandals are something that they're tackling head on, and it's up to NBC to decide how they want to cover it and whether they want to cover it.
How they want to cover the drug scandal that's going to go alongside all the competition.
Because it's going to be there. It's going to be in every sport. I mean, when I took a ride through the Chula Vista Olympic Training Center campus in California and saw the archery section, I was told by one of the people giving me the tour that in archery you take some of these drugs to slow your heart rate down so that it doesn't cause your hand to tremble quite so much. I mean, it's in every sport. It just so happens that track and field has been given the most attention.
Bill Saporito, as people watch the Athens Olympics then, and the Olympics, I don't know, going forward from now, how should they look at this, that these are human beings like themselves, assuming they're not on steroids or some other drugs themselves, performing at incredible levels, or that these are engineered human beings, chemically enhanced human beings, setting these records, doing the things they do? What's the Olympic way now?
Well, the Olympic way seems to be to get away with what you can, and that's why we have to have a significant effort in doping control. And we've reported this week, actually, that the doping is going to get better as we go on. For instance, some of the research that's being done into muscular dystrophy may produce some gene-based remedies that are designed to help people with that disease. But one of the side effects is that athletes will be able to build muscle without leaving any trace in the bloodstream. So this can get more interesting as we move ahead.
Well, does that mean then, what do you think, Sean Assale, that increasingly we're going to see Olympic athletes as enhanced versions of the human being, not like us, as if they were so much like us to begin with, but I mean really chemically enhanced? Is that where we're headed? Is that where we are?
Yeah, I think this is a philosophical question to some extent without answer. I mean, how do you look at, I just happened to have watched something on Freddie Adu, the 14-year-old soccer player.
Yeah.
How do you look at him or any of these sort of naturally gifted Olympians and say that the luck of the genetic lottery should allow them to necessarily be head and tails above the person next to them who's competing? I mean, to some extent, the genetic lottery has given some competitors a perfect set of genes with which to compete. Others are trying to catch up. And I think Bill's absolutely right. I think what you're going to see is turning towards the kinds of drugs that almost exactly mimic the human physiology so they cannot be detected. I mean, there's another drug right out there now, a version of the oxygen blood carrier EPO, mm-hmm. that is so close to what we produce that it's almost undetectable. So where's the frontier? I think the game of cat and mouse between the cheaters and the catchers is just going to get more and more and more sophisticated.
And the line is fuzzy already. Take us into track and field and what we can expect this year, Sean. That's where, on the American side at least, the doping problems looked more severe. But doping aside, what can Americans look forward to seeing their track and field competitors do in Athens?
Well, I mean, I think you have a reasonably strong team in the 100 meters. I mean, you have Maurice Greene, who's looking as good as he has looked in years, trying to take back the world's fastest man mantle that was briefly held by Tim Montgomery.
Right.
Tim Montgomery has since been found to have set that record, largely aided by drugs. So you're looking at a very strong Maurice Greene and two relative newcomers, Justin Gatlin, who I really, really like. He's at formerly the University of Tennessee, and Sean Crawford, who ran a really strong time in the trials, 9.93. So you have a great men's team. You have a kind of an interesting women's team. I mean, the women's team just recently this week rocked by scandal when second-place finisher Tori Edwards got bounced. So that's in a bit of an upheaval. But I don't know that these scandals have wildly harmed America's chances to medal.
And, Bill, yeah?
Yes, we've been writing about this new group that's personified by Gatlin and Crawford, and on the women's team, Allison Felix, who's an 18-year-old, came pro out of high school, and they call themselves, these are the new kids, and they call these older athletes, old in this case being over 25, I guess, they call them the old heads. You know, let's get rid of the old heads. We're the new guys. We're clean. Just judge us by that.
And say,
the other thing about the track side is that we're great anything from 800 meters and below. In the middle and long distances, the U.S. has been nowhere for decades now, really been left behind by the African runners. It's sort of an interesting time right now.
And what about, Bill, world records or Olympic records at this year's gathering in Athens? There's been this conversation going on about whether or not we can expect to endlessly see records fall at every one of these huge gatherings. Are records expected to fall in their typical number this year, or are we hitting limits?
I don't think we're at the limits, certainly not in swimming. We're going to see records fall like crazy this year. The U.S. has a very strong team. The Australians still have Ian Thorpe, Grant Hackett. I think records will be falling.
Of course, everyone there is talking, Sean Assale, about Michael Phelps, the guy who's on the cover of every magazine right now.
Including
ESPN Magazine.
And Time.
The guy we're reading with what his arm span is, arm span longer than his height. Very unusual for human physiology, Sean.
Yeah, I mean, I think that NBC is going to push him hard. Already we've seen Madison Avenue embrace him, and there's the inevitable callback to Mark Spitz. So I think we're going to look at Phelps Mania in the first half. I mean, what NBC has done here is they've recognized that and front loaded with swimming and back loaded with track. So those are the two that rate the highest in America.
And Bill, what's the talk around Athens about Michael Phelps? We've heard other swimmers perhaps jealously say that he's been biting off more than he can chew, trying to go for a new gold medal record to beat out Spitz, that it's just more events than any swimmer, even this incredible young, 19-year-old swimmer, can pull off. What's the expectation?
Well, Ian Thorpe was saying that this is, it's ridiculous. So there's no love lost between the U.S. and the American teams, which the Australian teams, which makes the meet kind of very interesting. There's a lot more attitude into it. Thorpe and Phelps will be racing in a 200 free. I think that is Phelps' worst race and one of Thorpe's best. Thorpe's trying to win all the freestyle races, but that one they will be going head to head. So that'll be a very interesting contest. Phelps is going to blow away people in the individual medleys. He's lost to a number of his teammates in a few other events, the 100 fly, for instance, to Ian Crocker. So, again, records will be falling. The U.S. has a great swim team, and Phelps can pull this off, but he's got significant competition within his own team.
And we can be confident that we'll see a big story sewn around that. And there is a big story there. I want to turn to our callers. A lot are waiting to join us. Carl is calling from Ocean County, New Jersey. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
The thing I'm looking forward to most is actually pretty much the same thing every Olympics, except it holds a lot more water these days. And that is just a genuine interest in a peaceful gathering of the world's citizens. I'm really looking forward to seeing people from all over the world gather on one field. I think it's really important these days. I'm really just praying for a peaceful outcome.
So kind of a sight for sore eyes, a balm you're looking for in that image of global athletic competition. Carl, thanks for your call. Shauna Sale, is Carl going to get what he's looking for in Athens?
Oh, boy, do I hope so. You know, I mean, the show of military and, you know, intelligence might over there is going to be second to none. You know what? I mean, we live in perilous times, but boy, I hope so.
I have to say, Bill Saporito, I was in Athens a couple of years ago, and the ancients are everywhere in the air there. It certainly sets a tone that harkens back to what we think of as the ideal of the Olympics, that we're reading a lot lately about how tough, brutal, and nasty the ancient Olympics were.
Well, they were not only brutal and tough, there was betting and scandal and, you know, everything that we associate with modern Olympics. We did not invent, by the way. But they did stop wars, or at least that's what the history says happened, or held off for a while. And it is quite an interesting thing to be at an Olympics. I covered Sydney, and it was a tremendous amount of fun. You had a security aspect over that. Same with Salt Lake, too, more so. But once you get there and you relax a little bit, you do get that sense, and you do really enjoy it. I mean, to be in Sydney when Kathy Freeman won her race for basically carrying a whole country on her back was just spectacular. So there's a lot of great moments that an Olympics can provide.
And we know that NBC will build those up. All the coverage will build those up. But, Bill, when you're there among the athletes, they must create a lot of it themselves, just in the excitement of being among, gathered with all the world's best, all in one place.
Well, all the world's best. They're all, you know, there's a lot of young people together. They're having a great time. I mean, this is, it's a party place in the Olympic Village, particularly once your event is done. Then you can really go nuts, and they do.
Have a great time. Helen is calling from New York City. Hi, Helen. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
I tell you what I'm looking forward to is some focus. Specifically, my favorite is the women's basketball, but to look at the women's teams. And I find it like I want to beat my head against the wall a little bit that we've had the amazing dream team on the men's side, and now this year they're even getting more attention for not being a dream team when I look at who's representing the women and their commitment to international ball, to the world champions, we've got a three-time Olympians, and I want.
Right.
I really am intrigued by the duality in coverage. You know, they just won today in Spain, and
you want more coverage for the women's basketball team, and you want to see it for women in general at these Olympics.
Yeah, I think. I mean, I look at the volleyball. I know the women's team has a strong chance, not only in the indoors but outdoors. I look at the softball. I know that the U.S. men's team doesn't have a chance in baseball. I look at the women's basketball. Their record is basically unblemished for the past three Olympics and through the World Championships. And
that's why they're not a story, in a sense.
Yeah, because... I mean, but you know, they could be a story if somebody honored the fact that, you know, those are the women who have built actually build a professional league in connection with it and have really committed to the spirit of the Olympic Games.
Helen, we've got it. Let us pick it up, and thanks for your call. Bill, how about it? I mean, I'm looking at this chart of the percentage of women participating at the Games, and it has climbed very steadily. This year, if I've got it right, more than 4,000 women here compared to about 6,500 men. Oh, that's in Australia. I'm not sure what it would be this year. That was in Sydney. But in coverage, do you expect to see women as visible, prominent, equal time-ish almost with men?
Well, certainly in terms of gymnastics, they own that event. We've also added some women's events this year. Women's wrestling joins the Olympic slate this for the first time, and that should be, you know, I hope it gets a lot of coverage. It deserves it. There's a new fencing category for women, the saber is actually a cavalryman sword, and this is the first time that women are going to be allowed to participate in that event. Our women's soccer team certainly has gotten tons and tons of coverage, and hopefully will get what they deserve. In beach volleyball, Misty May and Kerry Walsh are the world champions, and they will get a lot of coverage. Same thing in diving. Laura Wilkinson, again, a world champion. So, and in the track events, absolutely.
And what about that U.S. women's basketball team? What are their prospects?
Well, they're the gold medal favorites. There it's not likely that they will lose a game. What makes the men's side interesting is that this is the first time that they actually look vulnerable. They were beaten by Italy, who didn't qualify for the games.
Ouch.
And they seem to be pulling it together over the last couple of training games. But, you know, that's sort of fun and interesting and great when you think about it. The NBA has been pushing globalization for years, and now it's finally happening. And one of the consequences of that is, hey, we may lose. I mean, that's terrific.
Can I actually just weigh in just on
yes,
one
please,
small
Sean.
Point? I think that the men's basketball team is actually, if you'll forgive me, just a terrible story. I mean, it's a story about, you know, A-list players who just decided they didn't want to represent their country. It's about Allen Iverson and you know, others who went in thinking that they could win with their eyes closed and had to be benched. I mean, it's a story of every cliche of overpaid, over-pampered, selfish athletes that you can imagine. I think the men's team is just, you know, it's just a terrible story. And if they do rally to win, I'm not going to have any sort of feel-good, you know, rah-rah attitude about it. I'm just, you know, I'm going to say, then, you know, I wish they were beat. On the other hand, I would love to see the women's team get a ton of airtime. First of all, the WNBA is struggling. The NBA is trying as hard as it can to push it, and it's getting absolutely no traction. It has, despite, you know, any number of just wonderful, you know, wonderful players. I mean, it's got no Brandi Chastain breakout star yet. And I think that these games could really help put women's basketball over the top. And you know, if you ask around on a lot of playgrounds, I mean, that's a sport that is on the cusp of making it here, but it's financially struggling. So I think your caller was right. I'd love to see a lot more airtime devoted to women's basketball, and I hope that does happen.
Who does the U.S. women's basketball team have to beat? Who do the U.S. men have to beat?
Well, the men, I mean, they both have to. Well, actually, the men have to run the tables. I mean, to be embarrassed as they were by, in the early rounds was by Germany was sort of inexcusable. The women, I haven't looked at the schedule closely, but I don't know that they have to win all of their games. I just think that they have to be exciting.
Be exciting to be on air, but to win that gold, their primary competition. Bill, Sean?
I'm not sure. I'll tell you the truth.
Yeah, you'll.
I guess we'll see it on the court. We'll see it on the court.
I mean, I kind of, you know, look. Forgive me. I didn't. Confess. I am not the women's basketball writer at ESPN.
Fair enough.
But I think the point here is, if NBC is doing a good job, if NBC cares, they will educate all of us to this. I mean, certainly they're going to, you know, stuff Michael Phelps down our throat, and deservedly so. But, I mean, let's hope that they bring that balanced approach. That is what I'd like to see, so they can educate us.
Bill Saporito at Time, Sean Assell at ESPN Magazine. Stand by. We're talking tonight about the curtain going up this week at the Athens Olympics. Are you pumped up for the Athens Games? Will you be watching? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Olympics coming home to Greece this year, 108 years after their modern revival. You can join our conversation tonight. Has the helter-skelter race to be ready in Athens turned you on or turned you away? What's the event you're waiting for? Are you a Michael Phelps fan waiting poolside? And what exactly, honestly, is being celebrated in Athens this week? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Bill Saporito, editor-at-large at Time Magazine, in charge of their big Olympic coverage in Athens, and also by Sean Assell, also in New York, author and senior writer at ESPN Magazine, also covering the big Olympics opening this week in Athens. Neil is joining us right now from Yonkers, New York. Hi, Neil. You're on the air.
Good evening. I am excited about the Olympics and somewhat relieved that it's actually going to go ahead.
No kidding.
Like it wasn't.
Yeah.
I have to say, I'm going to have a slight beef here. One of the things I really like about the Olympics is the opportunity to see and enjoy sports that we don't normally get to see. Judo, trampolining, a new event I understand this year, badminton, archery, rowing, sailing. I have to say, and here's my beef, sorry guys, one of the things I don't want to see is basketball, baseball, football, tennis. We have plenty of coverage and airtime for those events all the time. And I sympathize with the last caller talking about the women's basketball, a little bit different. But hey, give us a break, guys. Let's look at some of the other sports that are played in the world. Do we have to say the same stuff all the time?
And let's get some of that tremendous variety out there. Neil, thanks for your call. Bill Cesarito, how about it? When you look at the coverage, I understand there's going to be an incredible volume of coverage from between NBC and MSNBC and CNBC. Are people going to be able to see right down to those less often viewed games?
Well, first of all, I'm a print guy, so don't hold me responsible for the
broadcast
stuff. You will, because of the NBC now has 3-4 channels to use, and they can use them 24 hours a day. You can now you'll be able to see, you know, team handball and badminton and all kinds of stuff. I don't think you're going to be able to avoid the big sports, gymnastics, swimming, basketball. You're just not going to avoid it. They're very popular in the U.S., and they're going to be shown in prime time. But on the cable side, there'll be plenty of opportunities to see the other things, and that's really been one of the great benefits of the 500-channel universe.
So if your cable is hooked up and you're willing to stay up until 2 or 3 in the morning, it's all going to be there.
Well, you don't even have to stay up late, because the coverage will be early rather than late.
Oh, that's right, because they're 7 hours ahead in Athens. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, and Sean, what do you know about the opening ceremony coming up on Friday night? We heard earlier that American athletes were advised not to make great patriotic displays and so on because of concern about security. Is that still out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that everybody's going to be, walking around extraordinarily sensitive to what's going on. Do I think that they're all going to listen? No. I mean, my gosh, these guys have, whether it's their first time or they've waited 4 years to get there, I don't think they're going to go out of their way to tempt fate. But I don't think you want to see a dispassionate, stripped-down group of people who look like zombies. I mean, I think what Bill was saying before is a delightful image of people who were, just thrilled to be there. And I think we want to see that.
And no doubt we will. It's hard to keep that excitement under your hat once things get uncorked. Bob's calling from Middleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. Thanks, Bob.
Listen, Tom, I have a different perspective or a different kind of question for yourself and your audience.
Sure.
And that is, if you use George Steinbrenner as an example of how he has utilized the media to help fund his successful tenure as the Yankee principal owner, is there no way to utilize or leverage the cable network's financing of the televising of the games and or the network TV's financing to then turn around and help support Greece and or smaller countries around the world so the Olympics could be on tour and be in places that are not just Paris and New York for the future?
So that generations of Greeks yet unborn would not be paying for that $7.2 billion price tag?
Exactly. These people will never see the day where this thing is paid off. And what good is that in the final analysis?
That's an interesting thought, Bob. Thanks for calling in with it. Bill, Sean, I don't know. Have you... What do you know about the economics here? Does any of what, the huge sum that NBC pays to have this go back to the host country?
Well, I got to say that I've just come back from a most delightful week in Barcelona on vacation. And if you could ever imagine, the city had gotten the 1992 Olympics, let me see, maybe 15 years after... I think maybe 15 years after the death of Franco, but certainly the city was nothing like it is now. And what the 92 Olympics did is it put an entirely new gloss on the city. It internationalized it and made the people feel differently about themselves.
So you're saying they shouldn't have a handout for money from media coverage? That it's worth it in the end, even at these post 9/11 super high security costs?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, I think that having an Olympics creates a international position, an international tourist position that you'll recoup from.
I think it, in Barcelona's case, yes. In Sydney's case, probably. I don't think it did much for Atlanta or L.A. So it's a sort of a mixed bag there.
No,
but in terms of using the money, though, from NBC, I think, General Electric is not a charity, So I can't see that happening there.
And yet the IOC could direct some of that money, could they not, to a host country? As Bob's saying, that might make it possible for it not simply to be in New York and Paris, which is what we were hearing earlier, might happen.
Perhaps, but here's actually where I think what NBC should be paying for. And much of the work I've done for ESPN has been lately on the issue of drugs and ferreting out drugs. And one of the more prominent people in the United States is a UCLA scientist by the name of Don Catlin, who says that the drug testing apparatus has been routinely underfunded. And he said if you could give him $40 million, he could wipe out most cheating in the Olympics. Now, whether that's hyperbolic or not, I do think that NBC could divert a portion of its money to assuring its viewers that the games are clean. And that, I think, would be a legitimate use of some of its profits. No, it's not a charity. On the other hand, it does have to answer for the fact that it, in some extent, by creating such a vast stage, is encouraging an escalation of the drug underground. And that I think, could be an interesting use of some of its money.
An interesting thought. Bill Cipriano, final thought. Here come the games back to Athens for the first time since they were reborn in the modern era in 1896, a century and more. If those folks who brought the games back could sit down at 2004 in Athens and watch them today, what do you think they'd think of the evolution in focus and theme and tone of the modern Olympics since their rebirth?
I think they'd think this is cool. A lot more events,
right.
Better refreshments. You know,
200 countries, 300 some events now.
Who knew the world would get that big? You know,
only 14 nations the first time, and now 200. It's pretty incredible. We'll be watching with excitement and a little bit of bated breath on the security front. Bill Cipriano and Sean Assell, thank you to you both for opening up the curtains on Athens for us tonight. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
So long.
Sean Assell, senior writer at ESPN Magazine, and Bill Cipriano, editor-at-large for Time Magazine. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, tension mounts between the United States and Pakistan over the handling of suspected terrorists. This is On Point. In the past 2 weeks, there's been a big spike in al-Qaeda arrests from Britain to Dubai to Pakistan. Information from those seizures has led to a heightening of security alerts in the United States. It has also led to disagreements between the United States and Pakistan over how to handle the detainees' arrests and the information they're producing. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is John Diamond. He's the national security correspondent for USA Today. John Diamond, thanks for being with us tonight.
Great to be here.
So here we have had, in the past just couple of weeks, two dozen or so al-Qaeda arrests, detentions, and now some concern coming out of Pakistan and out of Washington this evening about how those arrests have been handled and how the United States in particular, the U.S. government, has pushed for publicizing some of those arrests. What's the dispute that's emerging here, John?
Well, what happened was that the Bush administration came under almost immediate criticism for heightening the terror alert. This is Department of Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge, heightening the terror alert in Washington, New York, and Newark, New Jersey, particularly financial targets, based on intelligence collected from these recent arrests. It gradually got out within a day or two of the initial announcement that the information that, in other words, details about surveillance of potential targets by al-Qaeda operatives had occurred 3 years ago, for the most part,
right,
prior to 9/11. And so the feeling was, why are we heightening the alert based on old, stale information? That was the criticism. The administration responded aggressively to that by saying, look, at al-Qaeda, they plan ahead. The 9/11 attacks dated back to the mid-1990s. The surveillance for the embassy bombings in 1998 began in 1993. This is how this group operates. And they felt compelled to put out more information about the arrests, about the nature of the information they got. And in so doing, they revealed the name of Muhammad Naeem Noor Khan, who was arrested and whose computer yielded some of the most detailed information about this surveillance.
And this Naeem Noor Khan, this supposed or alleged sort of computer whiz mastermind of al-Qaeda communications, we're told.
That may be somewhat of an exaggeration. He is thought to be someone who helped al-Qaeda send coded messages, but I'm told that he wasn't particularly more sophisticated than, a pretty smart college student these days in terms of a computer. But he did have a lot of information on this computer with some computer disks, and it yielded a great deal of detail about the potential, the types of targets that al-Qaeda was interested in. What then developed, and what the Pakistanis complained about, and also the British, was that Khan and the information on his computer was being used in a covert operation to try to tease out more information, more names, more contacts in al-Qaeda,
yeah,
through the sending of emails under his name to people, to try to locate people,
mm-hmm,
to try to get the names of some of the people involved in this surveillance, try to see if the surveillance was still going on. And the complaint now is that that operation was essentially stopped in its tracks once his name and the details of this effort were revealed to the public.
That the U.S. sort of outed Khan and in the process undercut his value as an arrested asset who was yielding results.
That's the complaint. Now, all of this stuff is happening deep under the shroud of secrecy at, you know, undisclosed locations, presumably in Pakistan, where he's being interrogated, where the what they call Doc X, these are document exploitation teams, are going through the computer trying to find out what's in it. And, you know, they've had 3 or so weeks of confidentiality to work with this material. It's unclear whether that was all tapped out or not. And there is at least some speculation today in Washington, not the kind of stuff that's really confirmable, that that the release of the name was not sort of a slip or something that came under political pressure, but was something that was done knowing that what could be gotten had been gotten, and that revealing the name, revealing the operation, was actually something that could potentially sow more confusion with al-Qaeda, within al-Qaeda, more distrust. Now there might be a feeling that no email from anybody can be taken as valid. It could create distrust within the organization.
So maybe paralyze their communications. But the U.S. government's getting grief from the political side. Capitol Hill today, Senator George Allen of Virginia saying, in this situation, in my view, they should have, that is, the U.S. government should have kept their mouth shut and just said, we have information, trust us. We just got half a minute here, John, but there's a little bit of a trust problem, isn't there, when it comes to threat warnings these days?
Yes, there is, of course, and we're into the campaign season. George Allen is a Republican, so that's fairly unusual criticism. Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, one of the target states, said essentially the same thing in a letter he wrote today. We are coming into the election season. The president has an incentive to be seen as sort of the commander-in-chief of the war on terrorism and as being someone who is accomplishing something. Some of the most important accomplishments of covert operations and espionage, of course, are successful precisely because they remain secret. When they come out into the open, they are no longer useful. So that's the complaint right now.
Well, we're going to be watching those names as they continue to come out, and that U.S.-Pakistani relationship around the whole pursuit of al-Qaeda, fascinating subject. John Diamond, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Yes, indeed.
John Diamond, national security correspondent, for USA Today. He spoke with me from Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.